Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode of our conversation regarding localization. Today, we are recording episode 102. Can you believe it? I just celebrated 2 years on this doing this podcast a couple of days ago, and I am so happy and excited about the initiative that I started 2 years ago, then it's taken off, and I have recorded 102 with today's episode. It'll be 102 episode talking to influencers in our industry, thought leaders in our industry, and people who are taking the industry into the next level. And speaking of going to the next level, I'm honored to have with me today Vincent Henderson. And Vincent comes to us from France, from Paris, if I remember correctly, Vincent.
Yep.
And Vincent is our VP Strategy of Language AI at Lionbridge. So this is a very important position, Vincent, for the company A, for Lionbridge, and for the industry in general, to be hearing today from you your thoughts on where we are in terms of technology, in terms of our progress as an industry, and sort of give the audience who generally come from to the channel to listen to the channel from outside the industry, trying to get to know the industry, and also for those audience who are from the industry trying to get an update on where is the official roadmap, if you will, for Lionbridge from a language AI perspective. So welcome to the channel, right, Vincent. Appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, and congratulations on your 102nd episode. That's quite a journey. It's good to be able to keep it up for so long. And I've seen a number of your podcasts before. I'm very, very honored to be here. I think it's a very kind of active podcast and a very relevant podcast in the sector that we're in. And I'm happy to share my thoughts today.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Vincent. So, as we say on this channel, Vincent, the first question that everybody gets on this channel, and we keep this conversation, by the way, as casual as it gets. And two guys having a coffee over at, you know, and that's it. We're shooting the breeze and having a good discussion. So the first question that everybody gets on this channel is, how did you get into it? Meaning, what was your first, you know, spark, if you will, that says, oh, I'm going to get into the language industry, or I'm going to start something in the language business? Probably at the time, everybody tells me they have two things. Either accidentally went into it, got into the business. Some people tell me accidentally on purpose, you know. Can't wait to hear your story, your fascinating story.
Yeah, I think that my genesis story in the world of localization, I think, has probably a couple of prongs, I would say. The first is that I'm a multicultural individual by my origins. I was born in London. I grew up in Paris, but I also spent some time in my childhood in Mauritius because my mother was from Mauritius. And my father is New Zealand, and so I have this kind of very multicultural angle. I speak multiple languages, more or less good. But I mean, you know, I speak fluently French and English. I kind of get by in German and Italian. I have some Russian, you know. So I've always been into kind of the language sphere, and I grew up bilingual. I grew up speaking French in France and English with my father's family. So that's part of the genesis of, you know, why language. The other part of the genesis is around the question of more like technology and language, I think, and that's the thing that for me is the red line, I think, in my in my background. I have a very strong recollection of when I was a child or a young teenager, of the first time, and you know, I'm actually quite old, right? I was a teenager in the 80s. And I remember very vividly the first time I was confronted with the computer when I was like 10 or something like that. And I remember the moment, right? It was the moment where I understood that you could tell machines what to do. And this was, for me, it's a thing that was magic and amazing at the same time, but at the same time, not magic, because it was very kind of systematic and deterministic. And so I would say that these two loves in my life, which is on one hand, the question of culture and language and semantics. How do you represent? I was confronted very early in my life to the problem of how to say things, how to say the same things in multiple languages because of my family and so on. And very early on, how do you use machines to kind of get things done? And this was, I would say these are the two things. Now, how I got into the industry per se, I think that was, you know, also, I guess, accidental to some extent. I didn't decide to work in the localization industry, but I started my career quite young because the computer skills that I acquired very young were in fact my skills by which I entered the workforce when I was very young. I don't have any university degrees and the like. For example, I'm an autodidact. And but basically in the late 80s, early 90s, well, I'd say early 90s, having skills to code and develop and understanding computers and how to use them was more important than any other degree that you could have. And so I worked in computing for a while. I was working in a product organization in a game studio. Then I worked in the in an internet, let's say, a company, a very early internet company in the mid 90s. And basically, one thing, you know, I ran testing. I ran also the what's called the you know, after sales kind of customer support. I was involved in customer product requirements and the like. And just at some point, I through very serendipitous means, I got you know, I got exposed to an opportunity at what was then Linguatech, which was one of the predecessor companies to Bound Global Solutions. You know, thought the very, like I said, serendipitously was exposed to it, thought it was kind of interesting, and applied, met Tugdual Dolil. I don't know if you've had Tugdual on this podcast before, who is now the head of games development at not games development, the whole games business at Lionbridge.
Yes, I've had and, him on the we've had him on the show here.
Yeah, I think once, you have. Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing that. And so, and then we hit it off, and he, you know, he said, "Why don't you come and work with us?" And I came, and so that was in the 90s. So I worked there for, you know, in Linguatech, which then became Bound Global Solutions for a few years, and then I had a whole other area of my career, whereby I left localization. I went to work in publishing, again, relatively through opportunities and contacts and things like that. I went to work for a publishing services provider, which then led me to go and work for about 11 or 12 years for Wolters Kluwer. Wolters Kluwer, one of the top three kind of publishers in the world. And there I worked in the legal content division globally. And I was essentially in charge of applying technology and AI kind of technology systems around content, how to process content using technology. So I developed or led teams that were developing kind of either kind of two angles. One of them was like the content management system side, where we had these publishing systems that I was running and making improvements and so on. And then also ran for a number of teams that were developing information systems for lawyers, search engines, applications for dealing with legal information and the like. And then eventually at some point, you know, things, paths in life go in different directions. I did eventually come back to what was then Lionbridge.
Wow, what a journey, man. The exposure to various experiences and various skills that you've gained along the way, in addition to what you've had originally, must have been amazing to learn a new industries in some cases, or yeah, new features in some existing industry that, you know, prepared you to where you are today. People are on their mind, and I'm sure you're gonna tell me that there's a lot of learning throughout all this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the key. And you mentioned like going through different industries, that was really key. I think that, and of course, like I mentioned, I'm an autodidact, so I didn't. You know, I've never been very temperamentally predisposed to basically sitting in a classroom and being told what I'm supposed to learn. Temperamentally, I've always been a kind of a discoverer more than anything else. And every single experience. And in fact, you know, even in the late 80s, when I went to live in London for a few years, my first kind of real job was in a cookie shop. It was a Mrs. Fields cookies in London, and I'm a big cookie fan too, so I was quite happy to be there. But it was, you know,
look
I was
like
just
a cookie
hired.
Fan there, Vincent. You don't
yeah,
look like
exactly.
a cookie
well, I mean,
fan.
yeah, lots of cookie fans around for sure. You know, and even in that experience, it was enlightening to me. Like to, you know, I was hired in this cookie shop in one of the branches of the of this brand as just some. Basic, you know, person to work in the shop, and you know, and we were making the cookies and we were serving customers and so on. And even in that experience, it was almost one of the most formative experiences of my life, which was my first job, right? Which is where I discovered a number of things. I discovered that I loved working. I mean, that was for me, you know, being kind of, as I said, kind of having a bit of a complicated relationship with academia and school and so on, discovering that actually what I really liked was actually work and solve problems and do things for customers. And that's the second thing. It was the discovery of what a customer actually is and what it's like to be involved in a commercial relationship as a provider of something for people who come with a need or a want or something like that. And this initial experience, I think, has framed my whole career.
Absolutely,
I think in a
and,
way,
and
that's
it will have
been
a huge impact on a development of a human being. You know,
exactly.
That went through all this. It shapes you for who you are today. It prepares you for who you are today. Mm-hmm. I find, like, even for me, I'm not sure if you knew that, but for me, I come from a technology background. I mean, that's my education, mm-hmm. and I started early career in programming. At an insurance company. And then, I was doing actual coding, and that's like early 90s, 1990, 1991, mm-hmm. something like this. And then from there, I was, you know, I moved to IT management, and I was doing IT management for one of the largest couriers in the company in the country here. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the telecom industry. And I was an engineer working for the telecom engineer working in one of the biggest telecom companies in the country. And then, sitting somewhere, working on my Visio diagram, I remember, you know, doing a diagram on an IP network for one of our customers. We're going to have to deploy it and putting all the equipments, mapping all this out. And somebody comes in and sit beside me. And, you know, I'm a young engineer, only been in the company for 6 months. I didn't know who that individual is. He sat beside me and, you know, he said, "You're Robin, right?" I said, "Yes. And you?" He said, "My name is so-and-so, and I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what there is no internet. I can't look people
right.
up and see who they
yeah,
look
you can't
like
just
and
go
who
LinkedIn
they are.
And, yeah.
I don't know." And he introduced himself as the CEO of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Said, "Okay, what's the CEO coming to do with, you know, low-level engineer that's been in the company for 6 months?" He said, "I've heard a lot of good things about you." First, before we start the conversation, he said, "What are you working on?" So I said, "You know, I'm mapping out I'm designing a network for one of our customers. And, you know, that's what I'm doing." He said, "Okay, so I've got a question for you and an ask." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Today, I want you to be the sales manager." It just like for me, I felt like I almost fell off my chair. I said, "Yeah. I've got to be the sales manager. I tell the salespeople what to do. I don't want to be the sales manager."
Yeah.
So he said, he explained it to me, the sales manager was like having issues, health issues. "We have a big presentation and you are going to do the presentation." I never done these things before. And it was a large customer. So I said, "Okay." I built the presentation for him, so I know what it's in it, but I wasn't expecting me delivering it. I was doing the troubleshooting in the sales call. So I said, "Okay, I'll do it." So I got in the car with him that same day, within like an hour, walked into the customer's meeting, did the presentation, closed a $3.5 million deal a year. And on my way out, he said, "You're no longer an engineer. You're now a salesperson."
Exactly. That's how life works, right? It's
drives you in a different direction, doesn't it, Vincent?
There's no, exactly. There's no predicting the future. That's a big principle of mine, by the way, in general, in life, in business and so on, is that you can't predict the future. And I think that people who think that they can are wrong almost, and in fact, are wrong all the time.
It's true.
And so it's something that you always should remember, is that what matters is what's going on now and where you want to go. So you should act in a way for to go in the direction where you want to go. But it's not like the world is already determined that it's going to be a certain way a year from now. It's it doesn't work like that. So yeah, absolutely.
No, you can plan
both for your personal life and for the big world.
Life always throw you a curveball somewhere, and hopefully a good curveball, not the bad one.
Well, it's up to you what to do with it in the end.
Yeah, it's up to you what to do with it, and you know, grab life by the horn and walk away with it. So
right.
Moving our conversations to today, you're a VP strategy of language AI at LionBridge. For those who don't know, what does that mean? What is your job entail? Mm-hmm. If you can explain it to our audience, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So Language AI is one of our businesses. It's basically our content business at LionBridge, global content. So both content generation as well as localization. So I'd say it's the historical business of LionBridge. I'm the VP of strategy for that, which means that my job is, I was just saying you can't predict the future. So precisely my job is not to predict the future, but it's to try and make the future happen. So it's to think about what does the future look like that the industry wants, that our customers want, that we want, and so on, and to try and bring all of these pieces together to try and see how we can make it, produce the advent of that future in a way that is beneficial for everybody. So it's not about sitting here and predicting what's going to happen. It's more about sitting here, looking at the present and saying, how do we want the future to be? And then trying to act that way.
Shape the future.
Exactly. And in particular, before I was the VP strategy, I was the head of product for LionBridge. And so for a few years, I ran the product teams, developing new AI products and the like. And of course, what happened during that time in the last 2.5-3 years is the advent of, basically modern Gen AI, GPTs and so on, which completely kind of changed the picture, right? And I had been through my, I explained before, my course in my career. My career can be summarized as using technology to apply to information, to apply to content. That's my whole career is around that. It's about how to apply technology to information. The modern Gen AIs have completely changed that. You were talking about learnings before. It's kind of interesting because this really kind of took me by surprise, this new Gen AIs, because I had developed over the years, working with AI a lot. I was a bit of a contrarian, let's say, in the world, or really not a contrarian, but I was in a particular kind of group of people or a worldview who believed that modern Gen AI, the way kind of language is being used by computers today, who believed it was not possible. And I had all kinds of theories, and I could explain to you for 2 hours about why that was not possible for computers to understand language this way and to kind of blah, blah, blah. So I was really surprised by the capabilities that came up with the GPT starting at version 3. Quickly, obviously, adapted to this new situation, tried to understand why was I wrong before? Why did I think that it was not possible when it was clearly possible? And kind of completely reshuffled the way to address this question. And the question is really about the question of semantics, the question of language, the question of meaning, and it has kind of reshaped the way I'm thinking about those things. So I adapted to it very quickly, adopted it also very quickly when I saw the capabilities and the impact it would have on the localization business and the content business in general. So took our whole product line into that direction. So immediately started to kind of building AI into that and try to figure out how to adapt our platform to that and so forth. And basically 2 years later, you know, it became obvious, or a year and a half or whatever later, it became pretty obvious to everybody that the strategy of a company like LionBridge mm-hmm. is basically boils down to an AI strategy. I mean, you know, that's the name of the game, right? Strategy today means how you're going to use AI. And correct. So therefore, because I had all of this background and so on, I think it made a lot of sense for me to be kind of taking on this role, handing over the actual product, running of the product to a bunch of other people and working with them to provide a lot of insights into the roadmap for our product.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of LionBridge AI, language AI, are you able to give us today sort of an overview of LionBridge language AI solutions, and perhaps how would it be different, or how does it differentiate from everybody else that's on the market? As you know, and we all know, that every company out there, and there's 19,000 companies in our industry, everybody's on the AI bandwagon. Yep. I call it that, but you know, basically trying to either learn, catch up somewhere, somehow everybody's involved to a certain degree. From your perspective, if you can share with the audience, what is Lionbridge language AI solution, maybe the main pillars, maybe the main characteristics, etc.
So the you're right, it is a bandwagon in the sense that, you know, nobody has a choice but to kind of think about what that means for them. You know, not to sound kind of too trite or whatever, but I think there's also the question of what's your position on the wagon, right? Are you driving it? Are you following it? Are you running behind it? Are you kind of falling off it? You know, there's all kinds of relationships that you can have with the wagon. So I think that you know, I don't want to come across as being too self-serving or arrogant or something, but the fact is that Lionbridge today and for the past couple of years is a leader, at least in the language space, of AI adoption. We really adopted AI extremely aggressively, very early, under in part my leadership, but also our CEO, John Fenley, and, you know, most of the people involved in the let's say C level of the company and below. So we realized very quickly that something had to be done there. There's one thing in the industry that I think is kind of really interesting, and this is a podcast about, you know, this industry and the localization industry, is that I noticed that when people talk about AI in this industry, there's a lot of cope going on. The focus of a lot of people in this industry seems to be, we still need to keep a human in the loop, right? That's the whole, that's the story that a lot of people are telling about AI. Oh, but, you know, but the human, yep. It's so important. And of course, you know, that's not untrue, right? The human needs to be for sure in the loop of how AI needs to be used. But if you're spending your time defending the human's position in the face of the assaults of AI, then you're going to lose. So the approach that we've decided to take is to aggressively adopt it and to decide that we are an AI-first company, which means that everything we do, every single interaction that we have with the real world has to come first through the lens of AI. How can we apply AI to this particular circumstance? And then we try and do the best we can there. And then whatever the gap is between the ideal outcome and what we can achieve with AI, that's where the human spot is. And I think that's a big differentiator in our industry, of our positioning on that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Everybody says that, right? So, but Lionbridge took a more scientific approach to that notion. Am I correct?
I guess it depends what we mean by scientific, but we took a very deliberate approach to that. I agree that a lot of people say that. Not everybody says that. I hear a lot of people talking about how important the human is, blah, blah. And you know, as I said, it's not wrong, but I think it's the wrong focus. The approach that we took was to develop software around AI to have this kind of very deliberate approach to how we're going to use AI. And we developed in particular kind of a couple of frameworks that we call the Trust Framework and the Reach Framework, which aim to identify what is our relationship with AI. So the Trust Framework is the approach by which we want to make sure that the human-AI interaction adds value in general and is safe and is reliable and so on. So trust means transparency. So T, the first T stands for transparent. That means that what the AI does has to be understandable, auditable, and so on. And we have to be very clear about what's going on with the AI. The R of trust stands for reliable. So that means that we have to make sure that when it does something in a way that we can predict what the outcome is. The U stands for useful, which means that we don't do AI just because it's cool and, you know, it demos well or whatever. We do AI because it actually adds value to the process. The S stands for scalable, So that means that the way we use AI cannot be cannot just replicate like a conversation that you have with ChatGPT. It has to scale. And the scaling of modern AI is one of the key challenges of that. And it's not just about the number of tokens. It's about the reliability at scale. How do you scale your AI game in such a way where you don't lose on reliability? And that is the big challenge that I think a lot of people are struggling with, and we are very much leading there in terms of how that works. And the last T stands for timely, but it was mostly to complete the acronym, just because, you know, AI's goal is also to make sure that you reduce turnaround times and time to market.
Of course.
And things like that.
Yeah, deliver quickly.
Yeah, you deliver more quickly and so on. So that's the trust framework. The reach framework is one that kind of clarifies the question of the usefulness. Reach is a nice word in the world of content, right? It's about reaching audiences and so on. And reach is about when you need to use AI on a particular in a particular content situation, content set or whatever, you want to make sure that you apply this kind of thinking to it, which is, first of all, you need to figure out what the ROI of the content is. So content, and it's something that we tend to forget too easily, and it's a good practice to remind yourself that all the time, is that content has an ROI, which means that it exists for a reason. Any piece of content that a business creates, it does it for a reason. It's expecting some kind of benefit from that content. Otherwise, obviously, it wouldn't create it. So sure. What is that benefit that is expected from that content is a question that you have to clarify, the economic benefit. Because then that gives you a guide rail for how much money can you put into this content to make it global, right, based on what you're expecting back from. Because with AI, right, one of the things that comes in with AI, which is kind of new, is that you have a whole kind of spectrum of economic pictures, right? You can invest a lot or very little in your content, depending on the choices that you make. Yep. Beforehand, right, before the world of modern AI, you either had MT or MTP or human translation. That was pretty much it, right? So you either had MT, which is pretty poor, but it's really dirt cheap and very quick and so on. So it's pretty useful for a bunch of use cases, but it's very poor. You can't rely on MT for anything. So that means you have to do MTPE if you want to have a decent quality translation. Mm-hmm. The problem with MTPE is that, unlike what everybody's been saying in the industry, talking about the human in the human is not actually in the loop in MTPE. The human comes in at the end, right? You do the MT, and then you have a human review everything. That's at the end. Right, yep. There's no loop there. It's just kind of a linear thing, like MT, human, and delivery, and of course, human translation is something else entirely. But with modern AIs, you can indeed think about where the human sits in the loop of the processing, because modern AIs can take in context, they can follow instructions, they can make decisions, they can review their own work, decide whether what they did in the previous step was good, and so on. So you can have a whole bunch of iterations there, and the place of the human now is about managing that iterative loop. It's not about reviewing everything at the end. And in fact, what we want to do with modern AIs is precisely to stop reviewing everything at the end, right? We want to stop doing that. That's where we're going to be, right? The economics of translation at whatever, again, we can't predict the future, but we kind of know what the trend is. At some point in the future, there will be no systematic human review of everything that a machine does before it gets published. That's going to disappear. In fact, it's already disappearing to a large extent. So the question is, if we're not going to review what's coming out, where does the human actually intervene in this picture? And that means that the human intervenes in the AI. It provides examples, it provides instructions, it figures out what needs to be done at different steps of the process, like where, what are the specific things that an AI should be checking for, what kind of the biases, the errors that it makes, and things like that, so that you can fix it before you get to the end of the process. So that's the kind of general idea of this kind of thinking about the ROI, is that that iterative loop, and how many times does the human intervene within the process to fix things ahead of time, not at the end, that is what's going to determine the economics of your content. So the ROI question is really critical. You know, you can have a 1/10 of a cent translation, and you can have a 20 cent or 25 cent translation. Every single kind of layer in between exists as an option today with GenAI, depending on how many iterations you want to run and how much human you want to put in the loop. It's no longer like either no human or just the human reviews the machine or the human does everything. There's all of this spectrum that's there. And then, of course, with the AI, you have much more flexibility now to think about what is the actual purpose of the content from the point of view of the engagement that it's supposed to generate. So for the reach framework, like the first E is engagement. It means whenever you have content, it needs to generate an impact in the audience that it's going to be addressing. Like, is it supposed to get somebody to click on a button? Is it supposed to get somebody to have a better technical understanding? Is it supposed to have somebody think better about your brand? Whatever. There's all kinds of impacts that you want to have, like what I call here the engagement.
Mm-hmm.
The A stands for audience, which means you have to understand how to talk to your audience in order to produce the engagement that you're looking for. The C stands for control in our reach framework, and that means that this is everything that you have to implement around your platform in order to make sure that you understand what's going on in the platform, that you have data coming out of the platform, you have measurements. And the reason why I took this long detour to answer your question about the scientific approach that we have is precisely to get to that point, which is that the C of control is essentially controlling things through data. And the great mm-hmm. thing with modern AIs is that you can apply all kinds of different AIs and different configurations at different steps of the process to evaluate certain things, even automatically, to generate data about how reliable your process is. And based on this data, you can have more interventions and things like that. And of course, the H of reach is the human in the loop in order to precisely consume that data and make decisions about all of these other things that I've just talked about. The approach is very very thought through, very deliberate. We are not taking an approach whereby we think that the LLM can just be thrown stuff. You know, you can just throw stuff at the AI. Oh, here's a segment. Tell me what's wrong with it. That's not how it works. How it works is multiple iterative steps where at each step you're saying, here's a segment. Here's the context of the segment. Here's some stuff that gives you additional information about the context of the segment. Here's the terminology that needs to be used. Here's previous segments from the TM that have been translated this way. Please review exactly whether is this term used properly in this context. Is mm-hmm. this previous translation correctly applied in this new segment, and so on. And you can go through a lot of iterations and a lot of details for managing the quality of the output. And to be honest, this is a thing where the platform that we've built is one that manages all this and manages the human interface with the AI to make that happen.
Are you talking about Aurora AI in this case?
I'm talking about Aurora AI and the language AI kind of component of Aurora AI, is precisely the configurator, if you like, the AI prompt engineering framework and platform that we use as part of Aurora AI to apply AI to content. And we also have, so here I've been talking a lot about localization, but we also have a content generation business and a content generation solution as part of the Aurora, which we call Remix, where the idea is also to be able to generate content based on information that you already have and then localize it. So we have, for example, we have a recent example with a very large global brand, I'll say no more than that, a very large global brand where we're doing precisely that. We are actually, they have a product information management system, in fact, a set of product information management systems where they have product data in there, and they want to generate their commerce, e-commerce descriptions for their website, for selling their products. And so we have automation that takes this product information from their PIM, from their product information management system, that uses that information to generate descriptions based on fairly exhaustive descriptions of brand attributes, tone, voice, and so on that need to be applied, how to use this information to produce good customer-facing product descriptions. And then those product descriptions are being produced in multiple, you know, dozens of languages. And this workflow is definitely the workflow that everybody's going to be using soon. There's no question.
So no longer needed to have like marketing agencies and spend hundreds of dollars per hour to create this stuff.
Exactly. And in fact,
you can do it much cheaper now, right?
That's exactly right. It's much cheaper, much effective, even if you do a human review to make sure that you kind of capture, you know, all of the issues that you might have. The fact is that this particular project that I just talked about with this big global brand where we're doing this for their e-commerce site is precisely that work was previously done by a marketing agency. And the marketing agency, you know, was obviously doing all of the great marketing strategy and so on stuff for this big global brand, but they were also writing the product descriptions.
Correct.
They were charging marketing agency rates for this kind of work.
Absolutely.
Whereas with the kinds of approaches with AI, with our ability to process kind of massive amounts of content at scale with these kinds of platforms, which is one of the strong suits of a company like Lionbridge, because, you know, there's one thing about large localization companies is that we know how to push content through systems. And so therefore, the ability for us to kind of plug in AI in there was a huge advantage. And we were able to produce the whole thing for a fraction, literally, of the price of what the agency was doing before.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's funny you say, you know, how we move to content generation, because a lot of my audience would ask, you know, the question around, so, you know, back to your human in the loop, like that whole transformation, that whole reskilling, retooling, et cetera, of a human to get involved in the process, as you mentioned earlier. You know, where do we plug the human is very important. And now
Absolutely.
That has to be agile too, because as technology is moving, so is the function of the individual or a human being. Where do they get involved in that evolution of technology? Which brings me to one question that I heard this statement said like yesterday by somebody. I just want to run it by you and let me know what you think. Does the human in the loop statement, knowing what you know about technology and the evolution of technology, the prospect of technology, does that statement has an expiry date?
Yeah, that's the million dollar question, right? Is that to what extent will humans remain in the loop? I think that you know, I'm very wary of something that I heard once, which I always try to keep in mind, which is that which is in the context of scientific discoveries. If you ask an old scientist what's possible, their answer is very likely going to be correct. If you ask them what's impossible, they're very likely going to be wrong. So I'm always kind of very, you know, on the same principle that we can't predict the future and things like that. I'm always very wary about kind of making these kinds of claims. I don't want to be, because I have in the past telling people that this was not possible and it was possible. So I don't want to be the person who says, no, the human, there was always going to be a human in the loop, blah, 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 because you don't know. However, I think that if you accept that AI is going to evolve to a point where it's going to be able to make basically as reliable or as not reliable decisions as humans make, because let's not forget that humans are extremely fallible. That's something that a lot of people forget when they talk about human in the loop, is that they talk as though humans were infallible, whereas in reality, they're not. And in fact, we have data that shows that the error rate on human things is very often higher than what the AI does. We have data about that.
So this is interesting, because everybody comes on this channel here telling me that the human is better than technology. I want you to repeat that for our audience.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that and just maybe expand on it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. We have data that shows that when we do very systematic evaluations of quote unquote quality, we see that the error rate of humans when they do work, when they do translation or editing,
and I'm assuming
or whatever,
these are professional,
like of course.
You know, I mean, we're not talking about somebody off the street doing this work. We're talking about somebody who's professional, who's been vetted, who's been selected specifically for these jobs.
Exactly. So the precise data that we have is the following, and it's a bit more nuanced than maybe I let on. The data that we have is that in our pipeline, okay, in our AI pipeline, we have a process whereby at some point, without going into too much details, at some point, we have a segment or a text that has been translated, edited, improved, blah, 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 by the AI. And we ask the AI, another AI configuration, we say, please evaluate this segment. And we ask the AI to say, is this a good segment or is there a problem that needs to be looked at? And so that generates two sets of segments. One set of segments that the AI says, correct. And what if one set of segments that the AI says, nah, you know, this might need to be reviewed. What we have seen is that when the AI says that a segment is correct, it is right more often, or roughly the same, a little bit more often, than when a human post-edits a segment and delivers it as final, right? So that means that it's not that the AI does a better job so far in general than good translators at processing 100% of the text. However, when the AI tells you, I have edited this and it is good, but that is our AI, right? It's not just any AI. It's our AI with all of the criteria and the checks and so on that we built into it, plus software and so on. You know, it's proprietary source. Our AI is able to tell us that a segment is good, and we can know that those segments are actually better than the average human translated segment, professional human translated segment. That's the data that we have, right? So that means that there's still a portion of the segments that the AI says, I'm not sure about that. In that case, they need to be reviewed by a human, right, to finalize them. But when the AI says that a segment is good, it is good at a better standard than the average human translation, right? So it's a bit more nuanced than just the AI does a better job than a human. But the AI can do certain tasks and give you a level of confidence in what it does that is higher than you would get from a human, if you see what I mean.
Okay. Now, a lot of our listeners probably will think, AI is good, but I'm not sure about the security aspect of AI. Mm-hmm. And one of the items specifically in regulated market or any business that is more mm-hmm. concerned about their data security, etc., they probably have question marks on this one. Then there's a couple of dialogues I had here on the channel in the past week or so about AI being deployed behind a firewall versus AI that is, you know, owned by third parties such as Lionbridge or somebody else out there. Can you speak a little bit to how Lionbridge ensures security around the interaction with our platforms, which is AI enabled?
Right. So the kind of AI suffers from a lot of misconceptions, and one of them has something to do with the question of security. Of course, whenever you're implementing any kind of software platform or anything like that, you have to deal with security, which means you need to make sure that your software is not accessible from the outside and that it cannot be hacked and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. But with AI, there's an additional layer to the concern from what I hear from different people in the industry, is that a lot of people have this idea that an AI is this kind of autonomous agent, right? And that it's got almost kind of some kind of conscious being, whereby if you give it data, it's going to learn from it, and then it's going to regurgitate it in another context, and therefore exposing your data, things like that. This is the common concern that people have when they talk about data security. This concern is, ignores a number of obvious facts. Is that, first of all, an AI model is not a self-learning thing, right? There is no self-learning AI model in and of itself. An AI model is a stateless machine, which means that it's a machine that is, once it's finished interacting with you, it's in the same state as it was before. That's what stateless machines mean. That means that it is designed to receive some kind of input and give you an output. Okay? This is the interaction that happens. The only way in which your data that you give to an AI model can eventually find its way into the AI such that it might be regurgitated to somebody else or something like that, is if the person who is managing that AI steals your data and uses it to train another model or another version of the same model. It's the only way that data can leak through an AI. It's that this data is used to train another version of the model. So that means that the way to ensure security with AI is simply to make sure, just like with any other software, with any of your platforms that you're running in the cloud, in AWS or Azure or whatever, is just to ensure that the data, that first of all, your model is in a controlled environment, which is firewalled and all of this kind of stuff, that nobody else can access it, that it can still be in the cloud. There's no reason why it should be kind of internally, but it's firewalled in your environment. And making sure that the data, therefore, that you send to the engine and that you receive back cannot be snooped on by other people, right? That's the way you ensure security. There is no such thing as AIs autonomously learning from your data and telling what they learned to somebody else. That doesn't exist. The reason why people think that is because there's been a couple of instances in the past where people using ChatGPT or some other kind of chatbots online in free mode were then surprised that the data that they submitted to the chatbot eventually made its way into another engine, even though it was proprietary data. But that is not the AI itself that does that by nature. It's because you submitted data to an untrustworthy kind of website on the internet.
Unverified platform.
Yeah, probably, and IT then you're surprised that people were using it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So as long as you deal with people like Lionbridge, or to be honest, any other kind of reputable company, including LSPs, the data security with AI is no different than the data security for any other data interaction you have with us. As long as your software is in the cloud, which is the case of the software of most companies today, it's in the cloud. Therefore, you're trusting Microsoft, you're trusting AWS, you're trusting some third-party intermediary to deal with your data in a responsible manner. You make sure that you have contracts that stipulate that you are not allowed to use this data for other things and so forth, and then it's fine. Then it's fine. There's no magic with AIs that magically kind of reuse your data. It doesn't work. It doesn't work like
that. Correct. Now, I know we're coming up to the end of our conversation. I'm enjoying this conversation. Wow. I can keep you on here for 2 hours, but I know you have other business. And it's Friday late for you in the afternoon in France, so I don't want to keep you too long. Just one last question that everybody is talking about right now. It's buzzing. DeepSeek. Do you have an opinion about it?
I do, of course. Yes, I have an opinion about a lot of things. But you know, I try to have informed opinions about things that I know about. So DeepSeek, we've obviously been testing DeepSeek. I myself have done a lot of interactions with it. And tests and so forth. Now, it's a good question because it's a good wedge into a different kind of conversation. DeepSeek is essentially so I'm not going to reiterate what everybody's read in the papers, right? Which is, oh my God, they've developed this for a far cheaper than OpenAI, and it's revolutionizing the economics of AI. Blah blah blah. All of this is true. I have nothing original to say about that. What I do have to say about that, which I think is specific and that I haven't heard a lot, is that models like DeepSeek R1 in particular are very similar to models like Sonnet 3.7 and OpenAI O3 and so on, which are their reasoning models. Okay, so they are models that have been specifically trained to be smart when they reason about stuff. And so they kind of hit all of the benchmarks on maths and logic and all this kind of stuff and so on, you know, even understanding of problems, language understanding, and all this kind of stuff. But what we care about in the world of localization, the reasoning capabilities that we need are not negligible. They're quite advanced, but they're not specifically the kind of reasoning that these kinds of frontier O3 models and so on bring to the table. Not to mention that, and that's really really little secret, I would say, or kind of thing that people don't realize, is that if you use GPT-4o, for example, in a smart way, in a platform that is designed to get GPT-4o to first think about what it's going to do, to kind of identify the different steps that need to be run, to cycle back on that and reevaluate itself and kind of you know, go through multiple iterations before it comes up with an answer, then you essentially have a very similar kind of thing than you do with R1. The specific R1, DeepSeek R1 or O3 or whatever, the specific skill that these models have is that they spend time thinking about the problem that you have put to them. The fact that they spend time thinking about it is what allows them to give you a better answer. It's not that they're smarter. They're actually not. They're not smarter. It's just that they are attuned to be thinking about the problems that you submit to them. Because one of the big, let's say, unspoken truths about LLMs is that it's all about inference time, right? Assuming kind of similar amount of billions of parameters and kind of training data and stuff like that. Everything else being equal, it's all about inference time. And inference time means specifically how long is the engine going to be thinking about what you asked it. So if you use DeepSeek R1, as you know, if you give it some tasks to accomplish, you know, it spends sometimes minutes kind of telling you all about its life and like all its thinking process. And even sometimes it gets into loops and things like that. Same with sometimes O3 and things like that. Does this matter for the localization task, for the translation task? Not really. What you really care about in the translation task is making sure that the engine thinks about the grammar? Is the language used culturally appropriate? You know, there's a bunch of reasoning that you have to do, but we know what this reasoning needs to be. We don't want to rely on the engine to have to reinvent the wheel every time. So yeah. O3, for example, O3 or DeepSeek R1, you ask them, you say, here's a sentence or a paragraph or whatever. I want to translate it to whatever, Japanese. You know, think about it and give me the best translation in Japanese that you can. DeepSeek R1 is going to, and these models are going to first start to think about, okay, what is the translation task? What do I need to do a good translation? To do a good translation, I need to look up the terminology. So maybe I need to think about this word and that word and blah, blah, blah. And then I need to think about the whether the nuance culturally are appropriate. So it's going to reinvent the whole translation task. And the whole benefit that you're going to get from it is that it's going to take the time to think about that and to think about what does it mean to do a good translation. I don't need R1 to tell me what it means to do a good translation. I know what it is. Okay. Yeah. I know how to go through the mental process to do all the right steps to make sure that I have a good translation. Therefore, I can do that with 4.0. And I can tell 4.0, please look at this. Analyze this from this perspective. Look at the terminology. Look at the cultural nuance. Look at, think about the intent of the author, blah, blah, blah. And describe this to me. And then 4.0 is going to do all of this description for me. And then I'm going to ask 4.0, I'm going to say, here's the analysis that you just came up with. Based on that, what are the specific challenges with this text that we have here in order to translate it based on this analysis that you just produced? And then 4.0 is going to say, oh, well, the specific challenge is actually is that, well, this term doesn't exist in this language, so we're going to have to paraphrase it, whatever, you know? And I can take by the hand, when I say I mean my platform can, I can configure a whole pipeline that is going to take GPT-4.0 by the hand to take it through the translation task so that at the end, it gives me a perfect translation.
Absolutely.
So I don't need R1. I don't need O3. Okay. Do you see what I mean? Like, so
right.
I think that in the localization industry, I don't think that we need to worry about this too much, provided that we invest smartly in the platform that is actually breaking down the task of what does it mean to have a good piece of content or a good translation or an audience resonating kind of piece of content. Mm-hmm. We know how to do that and we can do it through a smart platform by keeping our token cost low. Because remember, right. If you're going to be doing O3 stuff, it costs you, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it's 100 times more than if you're using 4.0. So if you're using 4.0, you can take 4.0 through multiple steps. You can use 10 times more tokens than you would have otherwise. But in the end, it's going to cost you 10 times less than if you're doing it with O3.
That's right. And maybe we'll save that for the next time, the economics of tokens, I guess.
Exactly.
This is what you're getting at, which is, I guess, it's not an issue now if you're just starting, but it will become an issue if you become a heavy user. And yeah, my understanding is Lionbridge is one of the largest token users in the industry.
We're one of the top 100 companies using tokens on Azure in the world, and no other language company is in that, even remotely in that category.
That's a testament to our embedding of AI in our technology, in our process, in our products, etc., isn't it?
Exactly right. This is the, if you like, the demonstration of the AI first thing, like you were saying, Everybody says they're AI first. Well, we have the tokens to prove it, right? Every single one of our words is at some point confronted with some AI process that is evaluating something about it. And that's why we consume so many tokens. There's an interesting thing about the economics of tokens with the from the point of view of DeepSeek R1, which I think is interesting too. And then I guess we can wrap up given the time. But one of the big, I'd say, things that people say about R1 is that, it's cheap because it was kind of trained for this very cheap. It wasn't billions of dollars. It was a few million and so on, right? And that is true. That means that if you're smart like these DeepSeek people are, and you know how to train engines and to prepare data and stuff like that, you can train an engine like R1 for a fairly limited amount of money. Having said that, though, DeepSeek is a very heavy engine at inference time, which means that if you run DeepSeek on your servers or in Azure and servers that you pick up in Azure, it's not going to be cheaper for you at inference time than running GPT-4.0. Right, it's not because it's open source that it's free. It's a pretty compute-intensive model, right? So people should not confuse the training costs versus the inference costs. These are two completely different things. And DeepSeek R1 is a high inference cost engine, just like all of the others that have the same capabilities.
Absolutely. So, in conclusion, what I'm hearing is you know, instead of a user, instead of a user going in and saying, you know, I've got to put statements directly into ChatGPT or any DeepSeek or any other AI engine, I heard from you today, and I hope the audience have captured that, that there, it is, you know, the LineBridge AI solution for languages is a well-thought-out iteration, prompt engineering, designed in a way that we get output, exactly the output that we want out of AI, instead of guessing if this output is correct or not.
Exactly.
So now we have a certain degree of confidence in the output because we've done the pre-work. We've done the pre-work in terms of designing what we want out of the AIs, you know, make sure that we're first security, second is designing the prompt engineering and the iteration of how we give instruction to AI to come up with the right solution. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. I think in a nutshell, you've summarized this quite well, which is that indeed our whole AI first platform, the whole Aurora platform with all of its different components is precisely designed for that. It's precisely designed to create a human interface to the AIs that is maximally automatable so that we can very discreetly provide very specific instructions to the LLM in an iterative manner in order to take the LLM by the hand from an original segment to a translated segment where you have a very good translated segment. What we are, our job is not to kind of throw in an LLM into a translation engine or a translation interface, a CAT tool, just to kind of say the translator can kind of click on a button and say, improve this, and then I get a suggestion and then I validate it. That's not what we're doing. Our job is not to improve. I mean, what we're trying to do is not to improve translator productivity per se. What we're trying to do is to automate the whole process using AI. And the only way you can do that is by having a platform that iterates multiple iterations through AI workflows. And that's the platform that we've built. And that's the platform that I'm demoing to our customers all the time, and me and obviously other salespeople and solutions people. It's a platform that exists, that is running, that is, like I said, pushing billions of tokens through every week, and that we are very, very happy, very lucky to have. Because it's the best platform in the business.
Absolutely. So for the sake of time, I want to thank you, Vincent, for coming in and explaining to me and to the audience the LineBridge language AI business. I really appreciate that. It was a learning experience for me, even though I listen to your story every day internally in the way, you know, in a variety of presentation that we're both engaged in, just to have that perspective from the your story, from the way you present it to the public, it was quite educational for me as well. And for our audience, I'm assuming is quite educational as well, because there's a lot of misconception about, as we mentioned in our conversation. But thank you very much for clearing all that up for us. Appreciate it.
Well, it was really interesting. You know, we tried to keep it on a conversational level. We could do, if people think it's interesting, we could do a more kind of, let's say, demo of the platform or something like that, some more conversation specifically around the platform to show exactly what I mean by all of this iterative AI.
Well, if you're open to do a demo for the platform, I'm happy to invite you again.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do that.
Absolutely, we'll do that. And so thank you, Vincent. Thanks again for coming in, helping me recording episode 102. I really appreciate it. The Localization Fireside Chat is a self-initiative started by me, managed by me, edited by me, and published by me. So I don't have anybody paying me anything. I don't have any money being generated out of this. It's a completely personal self-initiative on my side. I'm driven by fuel of passion and patience and craziness. Thank you, Vincent. Thanks to the audience for listening in. I will see you on the next episode, 103, which we'll be recording next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Robin.